There's not a cloud on the horizon. As a matter of fact, he did a great job with his business deal, and everybody was going to be real happy. He closed the account in Atlanta, you know, or Florida or whatever. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. Here's somebody that ends up in the asylum when he drinks, okay? Asylums, that, and believe me, the asylums of the 30s, you don't want to end up there because they could keep you indefinitely. They could write down alcoholic insanity and keep you until doomsday. You know, so it's a place you really don't want to go. It's like Elena Lodge or something, you know what I mean? Please. I ordered a cocktail with my meal, then I ordered another cocktail, and after dinner I decided to take a walk. I returned to the hotel, and it struck me that a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. A complete insanity. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with the unbearable mental and physical suffering. Mm. You know, we do crazy things in blackouts. We travel. We meet interesting people. You know, have you ever had somebody that you met in a blackout call you the next day to get together? I mean, it's like, who the hell are you? Yeah. I quit a job in a blackout one time and then went in the next day. I didn't know I'd quit. That caused some consternation. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. So just knowing that you can't drink doesn't mean you're going to make a fight against the first drink. You know, that's what powerlessness is. If we could decide not to drink on our own willpower, would we be powerless over alcohol? When you admit powerlessness, that means that you are not the one who's in control of when you drink or how much you drink once you pick up. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. Mm. I tell that to, I usually give an exit interview to the guys that I sponsor who are on their way out, you know, the people who've backed away from meetings and everything. They get like one exit interview with me. I give them a call. And I'll tell them the time and the place will come. It may be next week, it may be next month, it may be 10 years from now. But if you back away from a spiritual course of action, and you're alcoholic, the time and the place will come when you will drink again. You will. And, you know, it's your choice. You're making a choice to drink by moving away from AA, whether you know it or not. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it will one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. And only two times in history, once during the Washingtonians and once during AA and a little bit before that in the Emanuel Group and the Osher Group, have alcoholics been able to recover in large groups been able to recover from alcoholism. This dooms us to death. This obsession of the mind dooms us to death. And all throughout history, alcoholics have drank themselves to death until they've gotten together in groups and found spiritual answers to their problem. And every once in a while, through religious conversion experiences, people have been able to get sober. And like John Coltrane earlier, that was a religious conversion experience, and he was able to get sober and stay clean and sober without AA or NA. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I didn't like so much. And then they asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. That's funny, you know, when you go on a 12-step call, we're full of smiles, you know. How bad do you feel, you know? Oh, you got another DWI, that's great. Yeah, we're like that. Because the lower down you've gone, the more willing you're going to be and the easier you are to work with, you know. I had to concede to both propositions. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I had exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action which 100 of them had followed successfully. That's the steps. That's the rest of this book. that we're reading. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow, but the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. Go back to everybody and make amends? It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window, like running your own life. That was not easy. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. That's one of the third step promises that you get. You get promises all the way along the line when you make when you take action steps. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. Note the word all. That's an important thing there. Spiritual principles have solved all my problems today. When I first came into the beginners meeting in Baskin Ridge, you should have heard my problems. I don't really even remember any of them really today. They were problems with bosses and problems with ex-wives and problems with living situations and motor vehicle problems and, you know, all kinds of crap. And today, all those problems have really been solved through spiritual means, spiritual principles. They had said that though I did raise a defense... I'm sorry. Where am I?
Bottom.
Oh, quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles solve all my problems. I have since been brought to a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I had before. Another promise. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. I like that. I wouldn't go back to my non-spiritual life even if I could. You know, you go through a spiritual course of action in this book. There really isn't any turning back. You turn your back on living a spiritual life once you've experienced it, and it's a very, very uncomfortable place to be. You can't survive it. You know what I mean? You know what I mean. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Can you imagine the type of bottoms these guys must have had? This guy goes to the asylum every time he drinks, and he's a high bottom compared to these people. He's just felt the nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have had to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems. And that's true today. You know, a lot of times you have to really have a bottom to be one of the people that's willing to go through the steps and go make the amends and do the inventories. I work with a lot of people, and until you've really experienced some pain, you're not going to do it. You're going to be one of the people that sit in the back of the meeting and maintain whatever type of sobriety that you have, well, good, bad, or indifferent. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. Of these men, staff members of a world-renowned hospital recently made the statement to some of us, "What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to the two of you men whose stories I have heard, there's no doubt in my mind that you are 100% hopeless, apart from divine help. Had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there's virtually no other solution." And this is a staff physician at a hospital. I'll tell you what, there's a lot of people out there that want our money, okay? We're supposed to be friendly with our friends, and I'm all for that, but there's a lot of psychiatrists, there's a lot of therapists, there's a lot of doctors, there's a lot of people out there that want our money, okay? And where do they come when they need to get sober? Where do the doctors come? Where do the therapists come? Where do the people come when they need to get sober? They come to AA. That's where they come. You know what I mean? So, just to make it clear, there's so many new cures for alcoholism on the market in the medical field. I was reading a book by George McGovern on his daughter's death. His daughter froze to death in a snowbank. Okay, she was a chronic relapser. And he didn't have a clue, because at the end of this book, he lists about 35 new drugs they have to combat alcoholism. The poor fucking guy didn't have a clue, you know what I mean, of what would have really saved his daughter's life. And he's saying all these new breakthrough drugs and everything. So you got to be careful. I think I told everybody last week that one of the people that my wife and I work with was sent to a doctor. The doctor prescribed this new drug for obsessive compulsive behavior, said that alcoholic drinking is obsessive compulsive behavior. Take these drugs. Don't worry. Don't go to AA. Don't bother with AA. Take these drugs. You'll be fine. And as we were driving her to the rehab one more time, we told her that she might have been misdiagnosed. Now, if some of these drugs turn out to work, believe me, we'll find out about it in AA. You know what I mean? But nobody's come flying into AA saying, "You guys, I stopped going to meetings, I started taking this drug, my life is wonderful." You know, there's not been one person that's come up to me and said that. When a doctor says that he has profound respect for the spiritual approach, and for most cases there's virtually no other solution, that hasn't changed since 1938 when this book was written. Alcoholism hasn't changed, and the solution hasn't changed. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. They're telling us for the umpteenth time, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Got a couple of things here. One thing of interest, I wish Pat C. was here, is there's an annual conference for correctional facilities. And he's been itching to get back into maximum security. Why, I don't know. Maybe because they'll let him out after the meeting this time. But anyone here who's interested in getting involved in any of the correctional facilities work, there's a conference that you can go there, and they'll, come up after the meeting and get the information. You can go there, and they'll tell you what your options are, what's available in the area, and it's a good thing to do. Kind of bridge the gap between the jail and the AA community. Some good news: we made it through Booker's again this Sunday. I have speaking commitments. Anyone can sign up for these. One thing that we do encourage is for you to have half a damn program, at least, if you're going to go out and speak, at least know a little bit about what the heck's going on. But that's really the only requirement, and that's not even a requirement. We just suggest that. But there's some good commitments here. Some of them are local. One of them is already signed up for that I was worried about. I had an Inglewood noon meeting. Figured that'd be a no-show for sure, but my wife signed up for it, so... I'll make sure that she goes. But I'll pass this around and, sign up. We've been going over for the last many weeks. We've been going over a lot of information on step one. We've probably given you too much information on step one in the preceding weeks. But basically, what we're hoping for is we're hoping that you're going to have an understanding of what step one is. It truly is one of the most misunderstood steps in AA. Hopefully, you'll be able to keep it simple enough to understand the obsession of the mind and the craving of the body. Basically, the obsession of the mind is the body before the drink. What happens to us before we start drinking? Why on earth, knowing how alcohol affects us and how it screws up our life, why on earth would we pick up a drink? It goes against all logic. And, we're not stupid people. So that's basically the obsession of the mind. What happens to us? Do we have something that we're powerless over? We're powerless over whether we pick up a drink again or not. I mean, how many times have we all stopped? It's not stopping that's really the problem. It's starting again. And we always have continued to start over and over again. And what is that? And then there's the body after the drink. And what that is that's the craving, or they call it the allergy in the book. And that is the first drink asks for the second drink wants a third drink, the fifth drink wants the sixth drink more than the third drink wanted the fourth drink, And if you're an alcoholic, it's had to have happened to you many times that you've got blithering drunk, and it wasn't something that you really wanted to do. It was a bad timing, it was a the wrong place in the wrong time, and you ended up getting smashed anyway. So basically, we need to look at that. And there's a couple of tests. One of the things is all the information that they give you in the book, if you can allow your experience, your personal drinking experience, and before you picked up a drink, if you can use that experience to confirm to yourself your own truth about the first step, that's great. You know, that's one of the things that we've been trying to give you information for here. If you're still unsure of whether you have power over whether you start drinking again, or if you have power over how much you drink when you pick up a drink, if you still think you may have some power in that area, there's a couple of tests that the big book lays out for you. The test for the obsession of the mind would be stay away from alcohol for a year. Just on your own. Don't go to AA. Don't read the big book. Don't do any of that. Just see if you can not drink for a year on your own power. The book says if you're an alcoholic, most likely you're going to fail. It's a very, very rare that an alcoholic can go a year without drinking with no spiritual form of recovery. The test for the body is the Marty Mann test, or that's one of the famous ones. That's drink 2 shots of vodka every day for 30 days, no more, no less, and you can't save them up. And if you're an alcoholic who has the craving, who the craving manifests itself in your body, you're not going to be able to do that. That'll drive you out of your mind to do that. You may make it a day or two, but if you're a real alcoholic, you're going to be drunk as a goat pretty quick, because it's going to set off the craving. So anyway, those are some of the tests. We're looking for our own truth about the first step. We need to know what it is. We need to know whether we're alcoholic or not. We need to know whether we have sufficient power to decide how much we drink once we're drinking. And we need to know if we have sufficient power on our own to give up alcohol entirely. And if you come to the conclusion, like I have, that you don't have power over either of those, you need to search for power. You need to look for power. And the first step is the fuel that you're going to need to work through the rest of the program to find that power. Because the rest of the steps really are a search for power. They're a search for God. And without a real firm basis in the first step, you're not going to do it. You're going to poop out in the fourth or fifth step. You're going to you're not going to go make amends to the people you've harmed. You know, you're going to poop out. So there's tons of information in this book about the first step. And we're slowly moving into the second step here. Tonight we were on the chapter We Agnostics. That's on page 44. And we're going to start the reading there. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. They went over that many, many times. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. So that really is probably the best single sentence describing our condition that I've found in this book. And we need to know the truth about that for ourselves. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And therein they lay out the solution. The solution for our alcoholism is a spiritual experience. The spiritual experience will bring us into contact with a power sufficient enough to relieve us of the obsession to drink, so we won't pick up the first drink if we have a valid, consistent, conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves. To one who feels he's an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible, but to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. They are definitely not. I can give an example out of my own experience. I'd been drinking myself to death. It was about 1984. I'd gotten my third DWI. I'd had maybe 10 jobs in as many years. I'd lost all my friends, and I was living in a room in my mother's house. I was about 28 years old. You know, I'd lost my family and the respect of anyone that knew me. And the booze was really, really getting my attention. I mean, my life was just hell. And I talked a friend of mine into dragging me up to one of these A&A meetings, you know, to see if I could do something about my drinking. And I went up to this A&A meeting, and I'll never forget, it was about 1984 or 85, and it was the Basking Ridge Wednesday night meeting, back when it was over by the Big Oak Tree Church. And I walked in there and I sat down, and I had a good buzz on because I didn't do well with crowds unless I had a little bit of ballast in me, you know. So I got half a load on, and I'm sitting in this meeting, and it was one of those touchy-feely type meetings. Everybody was talking about issues and stuff that I just couldn't relate to. I didn't hear really anything about drinking or about the type of alcoholism that I was involved with. I heard basically recovery stuff, you know, like upper level recovery stuff that I just couldn't relate to. I didn't understand what they were talking about. That would have been all right, but at the end of the meeting, everybody stood up. Well, one thing I saw was they passed the basket around, and you had to throw money in the basket. So, you know, that kind of got me got my attention a little. But the thing at the end of the meeting was everybody stood up and they held hands and they said the Lord's Prayer, and I said, "Oh no, you know, oh my God, I'm with the rollers now." You know, bad enough, they're all alcoholic. They've got a basket that goes around and they're praying at me. So I understand what it says, that it's not always an easy alternative to face. I was really dying from drinking, but if you were going to make me hold your hand and pray, I'm out. And I was. I went back out for about another 5 years until I had a bottom sufficient to make me think that I'll hold your goddamn hands and I'll pray. I'll sell flowers at the airport if I have to. You know, I'm going to die. And I came back in. But it isn't so difficult. About half of our original fellowship was of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. And that's like everybody. That's like the people who come to AA for 30 days and disappear. You know, they're hoping against hope that they're not really an alcoholic. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else we're going to die. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you, but cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. I looked up atheist and agnostic in an Oxford dictionary. It says here, the atheist rejects all religious belief and believes and denies the existence of God. And the agnostic questions the existence of God, heaven, and all the other things in the absence of material proof, and an unwillingness to accept spiritual, supernatural revelation. So those are the two definitions. I've heard it a little bit more clearly put, that the atheist denies God, denies the belief of God, and the agnostic believes that there certainly could be a God, but he's not actively participating in any way in their particular life. And that's really how I came in here. You know, this chapter says we agnostics. It doesn't say to the agnostic or for the agnostic. It says we agnostics. So that leads me to believe that most, if not all of us coming in, have huge streaks of agnosticism. Like where was God in my life when I was in the gutter? You know, how did God allow me to lose my family and all this? You know, if there was a God, you know, what's going on in Bosnia? You know, I mean, I had like lots of thoughts like that, and I was basically denying the fact that God could have a positive influence on my life. I kind of believed if there was a God, he probably was having a negative influence on my life. At one period of time, I thought that God was like a cosmic Alan Funt, who was putting me in all these crazy situations, and up there was St. Peter laughing his ass off. You know, watch him in the police station watching his DWI video. You know, I mean, just getting a big kick out of it all. And meanwhile, my life was like hell. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you, but cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. Like, let's take the churchgoer, the avid churchgoer, or, you know, that's a code or a philosophy of life. Just that in itself is not going to be sufficient to put you in contact with the power that you need. We could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted, in fact we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient, they failed utterly. This is about the 100th time it's told us that willpower alone is not sufficient to keep you away from the first drink. Yet you hear in a lot of meetings, I choose not to use today. I woke up this morning and I decided not to drink. That puts the power in your court when you think like that. Like it's your power that's keeping you sober. And if I've learned anything from the first bunch of chapters in this book, it's they're telling you that it's not your power. It's not your power that's going to keep you sober. It comes from a power greater than yourself. And if you continue to think that you're the one keeping yourself sober, or you're the one that's doing the things that are going to keep yourself sober, if you keep thinking that the power is, you're building the power in yourself, you're on the wrong track. That's not the first step. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where and how will we define this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. It means that we've written a book about which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, that we're going to talk about God. Here difficulty arises with agnostics. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. For we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. I don't know about anybody else in here, but I think it's pretty common for us to be hostile toward organized religion and a lot of the hypocritical people that we've come across in our past claiming to be people of God who have ripped you off or something, you know what I mean? So it's very easy for us to have a lot of different prejudices. We know how he feels. We have shared his honest doubt and prejudice. Some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. Perhaps we rejected this particular conception because it seemed inadequate. With that rejection, we imagined we had abandoned the God idea entirely. We were bothered with the thought that faith and dependence upon a power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak, even cowardly. We looked upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askance at many individuals who claimed to be godly, you know, like Jimmy Swaggart or Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. I looked askance at them, at least. I don't know about anybody else. How could a supreme being have anything to do with it at all? And yet, and who could comprehend a supreme being anyhow? Yet in other moments, we found ourselves thinking, when enchanted by a starlit night, who then made all this? There was a feeling of awe and wonder, but it was fleeting and soon lost. Yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. So that gives you an idea there how we can begin. We need to lay aside the prejudice. We need to put it off to the side. The prejudice against organized religion, the prejudice against so-called godly people, whatever type of prejudices you have toward God and toward a spiritual way of life, just lay them aside. You know, put them off to the side. and then get a willingness, if you don't have one, at least become willing, or pray for the willingness to be willing to believe in a power greater than yourself. And you can move forward with the steps. Much to our relief, we discover we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect the contact with him. You know, other people's conceptions of God, I never really was instilled with a terrible conception of God. I'm a Methodist. Now, I don't think they gave me enough information to have a real conception of God when I was younger, you know what I mean? It was certainly not beaten into me, but I've heard the experience of others who've been in certain types of religions where they've had brutal conceptions of God shoved down their throat, like the fire and brimstone burning in hell, 2,000 years in purgatory for swearing type of conception of God. And that does not have to be yours. You know, you can if you have one of those Old Testament gods that turns your wife to salt and blows up your town with volcanoes and floods out your lands and causes locusts to descend on you. Don't forget the locusts. You can get rid of that conception. You know what I mean? There's better ones around. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. So some of the action promises are starting to happen here, starting to be offered to us here. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. Seek and you shall find is an old spiritual saying that is filled with truth. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. This is an instruction. Whenever you hit a spiritual term from this point forward, ask yourself what it means to you. And if you have any difficulty understanding it, or if you have any preconceived notions that are going to cause you to reject it outright, talk to a spiritual advisor or a sponsor about it. You know, get some feedback. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to effect our first conscious relationship with God as we understood him. That's a great promise right there. You know, you begin a relationship with dialogue. You know what I mean? You begin a relationship with dialogue. And how I first started my relationship was I had a defective relationship. I had one of those when the cop car lights went on behind me while I was drunk kind of relationship. God, please get me out of this. I'll go back to church. You know, and that was about the extent of my but my renewed relationship. They say in here that we've been reborn. My renewed relationship with him started when I started praying. My sponsor suggested, Chris, why don't you try praying in the morning? Why don't you try praying at night? And I did that. And that's really when it started to happen for me, that I started to really develop a contact. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth, but if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. One of the Oxford Group sayings that I find a lot of truth in was Frank Buckman would train his people to, basically they were on a crusade to bring people to God. And how they would do that was they would say to the people, you have to start where you are. And you start by turning whatever you understand of your life over to whatever you understand at that moment of God. You know, you don't have to go to Drew Theological Seminary to get to a point where you can begin to allow God into your life. You can start where you are, wherever that is. That can be at the most simple or elementary level, but that's any starting point is fine. So we used our own conception, however limited it was. We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? Does anybody in this room have a problem with that statement? Is there anybody in this room that's not willing to believe that there's a power greater than themselves? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure them that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully and effective spiritual structure can be built. So this is as well as the first step, as well as understanding your powerlessness, this is very, very important to understand as far as where you're going to find the power. That was great news to us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. Like a lot of the dogma or a lot of the religious worship rituals of our past that we rejected. We don't need to use them as prerequisites for beginning our spiritual growth. When people presented us with spiritual approaches, how frequently did we say, "I wish I had what that man has. I'm sure it would work if I could only believe as he believes. But I cannot accept as surely true the many articles of faith which are so plain to him." So it was comforting to learn that we could commence at a simpler level. Besides the seeming inability to accept much on faith, we often found ourselves handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. Ask yourself this. Chris, were you handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice when it came to living a spiritual life? You're damn right I was. You know, in 100 million different ways. Many of us have been so touchy that even casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism. I rejected so much outright because I knew. You know, I was certain that I knew about spiritual things. I'd read books, and I read the Bible once, and I knew it was wrong in about 10 million places. And a lot of spiritual people I had a real problem with. I liked the type of spiritual people I liked were like the Timothy Leary type spiritual people, you know? They found their enlightenment through LSD or something, you know? They were my heroes. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. Though some of us resisted, we found no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. Another thing you hear in AA is, oh, don't talk to him about God. Oh, don't mention God to a newcomer. God will drive him away. Well, if God drives him away, alcohol will drive him right back in, you know? We're not on a membership crusade here, you know? We don't get a toaster for everybody we sign up. If they go back out because of God, good. Maybe, you know, they haven't had their bottom yet. Let them come back in later. When I was willing when I came back in. I was willing to hold your hand and pray. I was willing to cast aside some prejudice because I was dying. So, in this respect, alcohol was a great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. Sometimes this was a tedious process. We hope no one else will be as prejudiced for as long as some of us were. The reader may still ask why he should believe in a power greater than himself. We think there are good reasons. Let's have a look at some of them. The practical individual today is a stickler for facts and results. Nevertheless, the 20th century readily accepts theories of all kinds, provided they are firmly grounded in fact. We have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everyone believes them without a murmur of a doubt. Why this ready acceptance? Simply because it's impossible to explain what we see, feel, direct, and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point. I can relate this to Alcoholics Anonymous. Walking into Alcoholics Anonymous and seeing literally hundreds of people who at least claimed to have drank like I did, who were recovered and happy. How could I explain that? You know what I mean? Without having some kind of faith in something. Everybody nowadays believes in scores of assumptions for which there is good evidence, but no perfect visual proof. And does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof? It is being constantly revealed as mankind studies the material world that outward appearances are not inward reality at all. Here's an illustration. The steel girder is a mass of electrons whirling around each other at incredible speed. These tiny bodies are governed by precise laws, and these laws hold true throughout the material world. Science tells us so. We have no reason to doubt it. When, however, the perfectly logical assumption is suggested that underneath the material world and life as we see it, there's an all-powerful guiding creative intelligence, right there our perverse streak comes to the surface and we laboriously set out to convince ourselves it isn't so. We read wordy books and indulge in windy arguments. Has anyone in here ever read wordy books and had windy arguments? I certainly have. Thinking we believe this universe needs no God to explain it, were our contentions true, it would follow that life originated out of nothing, means nothing, and proceeds nowhere. One of the great things I heard was Nietzsche. Nietzsche was the great philosopher that coined the phrase "God is dead." And someone vacationing over in Europe went to Nietzsche's grave, and they have a little saying. You know, Nietzsche's most famous saying was "God is dead," and so that's on his gravestone. One of the great things I heard was Nietzsche. Nietzsche was the great philosopher that coined the phrase "God is dead." And someone vacationing over in Europe went to Nietzsche's grave, and they have a little saying. You know, Nietzsche's most famous saying was "God is dead," and so that's on his gravestone. "God is dead, Nietzsche." And underneath it, somebody wrote, "Nietzsche is dead, God." I love that. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation, we agnostics and atheists choose to believe that our human intelligence was the last word, the Alpha and the Omega, and the beginning and end of it all. Rather vain of us, wasn't it? It is vain to believe that there's no God and that this is all a huge accident and that we're such masters of our own destiny. And, you know, we've designed this environment we're living in ourselves. That's pretty vain. We who have traveled this dubious path beg of you to lay aside prejudice. They're again asking us to do this. Even against organized religion. Even against Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. Okay? You got to lay that aside. That was not easy for me. Yeah. Me and three other people bought the same condo. Anyway, we have learned that whatever the human frailties of various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. People of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about. Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatever. I used to think I had a conception. I used to think I had a really sharp idea of the world and all its machinations, you know. I really thought I had a unique perspective on everything. And I come in here and I learn, I have to relearn everything. The things I thought were good ended up being bad, and the things I thought were bad about myself ended up being good. You know, that was a revelation. I'm glad that happened slow. You know? We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness which we should have sought ourselves. And I used to see the guys going to church, the families going to church on Sunday morning, and I'd be hungover or I'd be driving back from a Coke party or something, and I'd see these people all dressed up and say to myself, what a bunch of losers. Well, they had homes, families, careers, cars, you know, the cops weren't after them. they were physically healthy. I mean, I should have been pursuing that myself, but I had a unique, dark perspective on reality. Instead, we looked at the human defects of these people and sometimes used their shortcomings as a basis of wholesale condemnation. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We missed the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing. In our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. And that's the stories at the back of the book. They were all designed to show you how the people came to find the power greater than themselves that relieved them of their alcoholic problem. Whether we agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. They are questions for each individual to settle for himself. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. That means everybody that was involved in the putting together of this book, all the people who wrote the first 30, I think, stories included, every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. As a celebrated American statesman put it, let's look at the record. Some politician used to say that. That was his big thing. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and to do certain simple things. What are the simple things? They're probably the steps. There has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. So this is one of the descriptions of what a spiritual awakening is going to be, what a spiritual experience is going to be. It's going to be a revolutionary change in your way of living and thinking. Okay, if you've not had a revolutionary change in your way of living and thinking, you have not had a spiritual awakening, and that means that you have not taken the 12 steps of AA to the best of your ability. The promises are also guides to what you haven't done. When you look at some of the promises, and like the fear of economic insecurity has not left you, that means that you probably have some events that you haven't done yet. You know what I mean? They're good guideposts to what's lacking in your program. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of the human resources, they found that a new power, peace, and happiness and sense of direction flowed into them. It's another description of the spiritual experience. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. And what could those requirements possibly be? They're going to tell you. They're going to give you the program of action in the next few chapters. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. I like this next sentence. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. Leaving aside the drink question, let's think about before we drank. We've all had sober intervals. We've all had sober intervals for one reason or another. Maybe jail, you know. Maybe we just swore off and with sheer willpower we stayed away from booze for a month or two, maybe a year. Leaving aside the drink question, let's think about our sober times. Was living unsatisfactory for you during that time? Well, obviously it was, because untreated alcoholism manifests itself probably more so in the sober alcoholic than it does in the drinking alcoholic. There's a lot of information in this chapter that's going to go over untreated alcoholism, what the spirit malady is, how emotionally we suffer when we're not drunk. You know, one of the reasons we drink is to get some escape, to get some peace. I was a tortured individual. I was tortured by fear, by self-pity, by depression. But you name it, I could give you 100 names of things that I was tortured by when I was sober. You know what I mean? So, leaving aside the drink question, we need to ask ourselves why was living so unsatisfactory for us? It's because we didn't have a spiritual way of life. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say to the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. But basically what this meaning is for is it's for generally giving information that's helpful for the actual taking of the 12 steps. For some reason or another in AA in the last 20 years or so, it's become okay to just go to meetings and to not take the steps, not work on the steps. And it's become acceptable for you to just sit in a chair in an AA meeting and suffer from untreated alcoholism. And what I found through my own personal experience is I was really looking for an answer back in the late 80s and early 90s when I came into the program. And I was really listening. And I went to about 4-step meetings a week, 4-12 and 12 meetings a week, trying to figure out really what they meant by the steps. I saw them up on the wall, but I knew that there had to be something a little bit more in depth than that. I had read the big book, but for some reason or another, the instructions on the steps kind of escaped me. And through my own dealing with recovery problems, I came across a set of Joe and Charlie tapes. Somebody gave me a set of Joe and Charlie tapes. And they talked about a program of action that I did not hear anything of in the North Jersey meetings. I just didn't hear it. people that were actually writing down amends lists and going out and completing amends and doing four-column inventory and all this stuff that you could go to 12 and 12 meetings until the cows come home and you're not going to hear about it. So I kind of shelved those tapes because they pissed me off. Basically because they put a big mirror up in front of my face. But after a while, I started to listen to them again. I started to change the way I was recovering from alcoholism, from sitting in a chair to actually taking some spiritual actions. And then I started working with others that same way. And circumstances ended up placing people in my house on Thursday nights for about a four-year period of time. And there's some people in this room now who actually went through that. And what we would do is we would go through the big book and we would explain how to take the steps to people. And they would actually take the steps, you know, to the best of their ability, whatever that would be. And that's really what this meeting is about. This is a different kind of meeting. We really try to talk about the solution here. This meeting isn't for everybody. There are actually people who are not real happy with the way this meeting runs, and that's fine. But I think that it can be helpful to the people who are willing to recover from alcoholism. And one of the things I've asked Scott to read is, I'm a great fan of the real early literature. I mean the first literature. I think anything after 1945 is very, very fallible. There's a lot of conference-approved literature that I don't see a lot of merit in after 1945. But we came across, from a group in Florida, we came across one of the early preambles. This is an early 1940 preamble of how they started the meetings back then. I've asked Scott to read that.
My name is Scott. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
This is from the archives, the original AA preamble. We are gathered here because we are faced with the fact that we are powerless over alcohol, unable to do anything about it without the help of a power greater than ourselves. We feel that each person's religious views, if any, are his own affair. The simple purpose of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to show what may be done to enlist the aid of a power greater than ourselves, regardless of what our individual conception of that power may be. In order to form a habit of depending upon and referring all we do to that power, we must first apply ourselves with some diligence. By often repeating these acts, they become habitual and the help rendered becomes natural to us. We have all come to know that as alcoholics we are suffering from a serious illness for which medicine has no cure. Our condition may be the result of an allergy which makes us different from other people. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently cured. The only relief we have to offer is absolute abstinence. The second meaning of AA, there are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Each member squares his debt by helping others to recover. An alcoholic anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application of an adherence to the AA program, has forsworn the use of all alcoholic beverage in any form. The moment he takes so much as one drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic beverages, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain sober for all time. Not being reformers, we offer our experience only to those who want it. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and on which we can join in harmonious action. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our program. Those who do not recover are people who will not or simply cannot give themselves to this simple program. Now, you may like the program or you may not, but the fact remains it works and it is your only chance to recover. There is a vast amount of fun included in the AA fellowship. Some people might be shocked at our seeming worldliness, and levity, but just underneath there lies a deadly earnestness and full relation that we must put first things first, and with each other of us, the first thing is our alcoholic problem. To drink is to die. Faith must work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. In order to set our tone for this meeting, I ask that we bow our heads in a few moments of silent prayer and meditation. I wish to remind you that whatever is said at this meeting expresses our individual opinions as of today and as of up to this moment. We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are free to agree or disagree to anything which might not be reconciled with what is in the AA Big Book. If you don't have an AA Big Book, it's time you bought one. Read it, study it, live with it, loan it, scatter it, and then learn from it what it means to be an AA.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. One thing I'll pass around, we have outgoing speaking commitments. Let's carry the message. There's some groups on here like Myersville. Boy, Myersville's hurting for the message. Anybody want to go there? That's my old home group. Pardon me?
I got it right here.
Oh, okay, there you go. That's we'll pass that one around, right. And
I will have copies of this.
Sign up, you know. The only thing we ask is have some kind of program, have some kind of recovery, you know what I mean? That's all. Anyway, we're going to start tonight on page 51, first paragraph down. We're on We Agnostics. We Agnostics basically is the chapter that it was designed to soften up the agnosticism in us. I don't think I'm unique in that when I came into AA, I did not want to hear about God. I did not want to hear about spiritual principles. That was like the last thing in the world I wanted to hear about. And the problem is the whole program is based on God and spiritual principles. So if I didn't hear about God and spiritual principles, I wouldn't hear about the program. And Bill Wilson understood this, and I think that's why the chapter We Agnostics was written. There's some guiding points in We Agnostics that if we follow some of the suggestions, it will help us to set aside our prejudices and allow us to have an open mind, at least open enough to accept the type of spiritual principles that we need to recover. Page 51, paragraph 1. This world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than all the millenniums which went before. Almost everyone knows the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of the material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought that a round earth was preposterous. Others came near death, came near putting Galileo to death for his astronomical heresies. You know, back in these times, they had religious dogma that would explain most things. And if you came up with a brilliant new idea, you know, you were at risk of getting burned at the stake. I mean, they had real serious prejudices. And they were afraid of anything new. And it kept them in ignorance. It kept us in a lot of ignorance. That's why, like in the last 100 years or so, we've progressed incredibly compared to the period of time before that. We ask ourselves this, are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? Even in the present century, American newspapers were afraid to print the account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Had not all efforts at flight failed before? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River? This is great. I don't know if anybody remembers, like, on Saturday morning TV, but they would do series of bloopers, and there was this one plane that it had about 13 wings, and it would go down this ramp, and it went about 4 feet out, and then straight down into the river. That was Professor Langley's flying machine. And this was the guy that Langley Air Force Base was named after, either him or his son, I forget which. But I mean, he was the guy having to do with flight at that time. There was nobody smarter. And a couple of idiots running a bicycle shop in the shore in North Carolina build a plane that flies, and they send out the information to all the newspapers. They couldn't believe it. You know, Professor Langley just went in the ditch. How could a couple of idiots running a bicycle shop do it? Was it not true that the best mathematical minds had proved that men could never fly? Had not people said that God reserved this privilege to the birds? Only 30 years later, the conquest of the air was almost an old story, and airplane travel was in full swing. But in most fields of our generation has witnessed complete liberation of our thinking. Show any longshoreman a Sunday supplement describing a proposal to explore the moon by means of a rocket, and he will say, "I bet they do it, maybe not so long either." And they did. Is not our age characterized by the ease with which we discard old ideas for new, by the complete readiness with which we throw away the theory or gadget which does not work for something new which does? First of all, our lives did not work the way we were running. And this is kind of what they're saying here. Would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? You know what I mean? Would you rather hang on to there is no God and, you know, spiritual people are morons and weak? Is it worth hanging on to that idea if you're going to die because of it? You know, they're trying to soften us up a little. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. This is the greatest this is the greatest paragraph in this chapter. Think about step one, the way it's written on the wall. We were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. What do they mean by that our lives have become unmanageable? I think this paragraph describes the unmanageability of the alcoholic's life more so than any other paragraph in the book. There's other areas that allude to it, but basically untreated alcoholism is characterized by some of the things in this chapter. And turn these statements into questions. This is a good exercise. I'll show you how to do it. T was having trouble with his personal relationships. And he couldn't control his emotional nature, and he was prey to misery and depression. He couldn't make a living, and he had a feeling of uselessness. He was full of fear, he was unhappy, and he couldn't seem to be of any real help to other people.
So valid.
Valid. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important to T than whether he should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. In other words, isn't it more important to treat this untreated alcoholism than to worry about religious intolerance or prejudice? When we saw others solve their problem by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. The Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment. Without that, nothing could have happened. We agnostics and atheists were sticking to the idea that self-sufficiency would solve our problems. This is really one of the reasons why so many alcoholics die. They're going to handle the problem themselves. You know, thanks for the information. You know, I'll talk to you later. And that doesn't work. A spiritual course of action, you can't get a spiritual course of action with self-knowledge. You have to take action. When others showed us that God's sufficiency worked with them, we began to feel like those who had insisted the rights would never fly. That solely happened to me in early recovery. I started hearing people that I really respected and I wanted what they had. I heard them start talking about their relationship with God. And, you know, I started to think that, you know, I need that too. Logic is great stuff. We like it. We still like it. It is not by chance that we were given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our senses, and to draw conclusions. That is one of man's magnificent attributes. We agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence, we were at pains to tell why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it more sane and logical to believe than not to believe, and why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, "We don't know." When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. You know, that's the first step. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't, what was our choice to be? This is a proposition, a second step proposition that you have to face. To get through the second step, you have to face this. Now, it can be God is nothing, and you can still move on. But following the course of action, hopefully you're going to change. Hopefully you're going to make the other choice. I've heard a lot about agnosticism in that, you know, if you ask me, you know, do you believe in God? Oh, of course I believe in God. You know, he relieved me of my alcohol, my obsession to drink and all this other stuff. But I'll tell you what, there's some agnosticism in my life today. And I'll give you an example. I'm willing to turn a lot over to how I believe God would want me to act, how God would want me to, the actions he would want me to take. I'm willing to turn a lot of those things over. But am I willing to turn my sex life over? You know, that's one that a lot of us hang on to. Am I willing to turn my work life over? Am I willing to do what I think God would want me to do in my day-to-day business affairs? That's another thing that's hard to let go of. So there's agnosticism in me that it's going to take a long, long time to work through. And this is why we look for progress and not perfection. This is why it says that no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. It's because there's a lot of work to do and it takes a long time. Arrived at this point,
Chris, before you go further, could you go into a little greater detail with that just a bit? Like, as far as, I know I remember a couple months back we talked about the current agnosticism, and I know to a lot of people it seemed like afterwards it was really unclear what you were getting at as far as agnosticism is concerned, as it's relative to sex life or work life. And to me, what I'm hearing you say is that, like, just turning it over to God with work, like getting out of your own way when it has to deal with work. Is that what you're exactly what you're referring to when you say agnosticism?
Playing God, using self-will instead of what you believe God's will is. You know, there's reservations. I believe in people. There's reservations in how far you want to go with spiritual principles on a day-to-day basis. The way I heard it described is, you can go to God with a thimble, or you can go to God with a bucket, with these steps, doing this step work. And what you go there with, you're gonna get. And a lot of times, it's our old ideas that we're holding on to, that we don't let go of. That's our current agnosticism. Does that help at all?
I think it makes a lot clearer. Thank you.
Arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. The outlines and the promise of a new land had brought luster to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't quite step ashore. Perhaps we had been leaning too heavily on reason that last mile, and we did not like to lose our support. This is like what we're, you know, it's very, very difficult to turn a lot of this stuff over. I was ready to turn my alcoholism over the day I walked in here, and I did. I believe that the same thing will happen when it comes time for me to turn my sex life over, or I make the decision to turn my work life over and do what I think God would have me do. I think wonderful things will happen, but I'm still holding on to old ideas. And, you know, I don't mean to speak for everybody, but I think that everyone can relate to the facts that there are some things that you're not doing the way you think God would have you do. And it's, you know, it's progress, not perfection. It takes a while. That was natural, but let us think a little more closely. Without knowing it, we had been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith. For did we not believe in our own reasoning? Did we not have confidence in our ability to think? What was that but a sort of faith? Yes, we had been faithful, abjectly faithful to the God of reason. So in one way or another, we discovered that faith had been involved all the time. We found, too, that we had been worshipers. What a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. Had we not variously worshipped people, sentiment, things, money, ourselves? And then with a better motive, have we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower? Who of us had not loved something or somebody? How much did these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing we saw at last. Were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say we had no capacity for faith or love or worship. In one form or another, we had been living by faith and little else. I heard one time, and this really rang true for me, that you can develop faith the same way that you developed faith in alcohol. I'll give you an example. Before I took that bottle of Four Roses whiskey down from my mother's liquor cabinet when I was 13 years old and got drunk for the first time, if you would have walked up to me and you would have said, "Chris, inside this bottle is the answer to all your social problems. This bottle is going to get rid of all the little fears and insecurities you have. It's going to make you larger than life. You are going to be the funniest guy in the world. There's dancing lessons in this bottle. And it's going to give you a whole new attitude and outlook on life. You know, you are going to be living large." And then in about 10 years, it's going to strip away everything you care about in life. Now, if you would have told me that when you handed me the bottle, I would have said, "You're full of shit. You know, that's not possible." But I'll tell you what, I came to have faith in alcohol. I came to have faith in that it was going to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And then in the end, I slowly started to have faith that it was destroying my life, and I had to get rid of it. And that came through personal experience. The same thing is true with having faith with God. If you follow the spiritual exercises of steps 4 through 9, and then the growth steps of steps 10 through 12, if you practice those on a daily basis to the best of your ability, you can't not have a strong growing faith in God, because that's what they're designed to do. They're designed to take away the things that block you from a good relationship with God. They're the things that are meant and designed to heal your spirit so that your spirit isn't so tarnished that you can't develop an adequate and comfortable relationship with a higher power. You know what I mean? It's not that God's going to love you more when you take these actions, because I believe, at least with my higher power, He loves me whether I'm taking the actions or not. It's to heal our spirit so that we can access the higher power. You know what I mean? Anyway, imagine life without faith, where nothing left but pure reason. It wouldn't be life. But we believed in life. Of course we did. We could not prove life in the sense that you can prove a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, yet there it was. Could we still say the whole thing was nothing but a mass of electrons created out of nothing, meaning nothing, whirling onto a destiny of nothingness? Of course we could. The electrons themselves seem more intelligent than that, at least so the chemist said. Hence we saw that reason isn't everything, neither is reason, as most of us use it, entirely dependable, though it may emanate from our best minds. What about people who prove that men can never fly? Yet we've been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. You see that the first day you walk into AA, if you believe what the people are telling you. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but we liked to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or another it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup just as much as the feeling we had for a friend. Anybody in here remember the foxhole prayers? You may have discounted God 99.9% of the time. But let's say the cops are pulling you over and you just cut a whiskey bottle in half or something. You know, you're gonna be a praying fool. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but He was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us, and the last analysis, only there where He may be found, it is so with us. That just told us where we're going to find God. I used to think I would have to go back to church to find God. You know, I thought all kinds of things. I thought I'd have to go to Yale Divinity School to be able to understand all the theological dribble, to be able to really get with God. God is inside each of us. We merely need to look inside. You'll hear in AA that spiritual growth is an inside job. We're people who come into AA who are victims of bad breaks, misunderstandings, and unlucky circumstances. And it's all those some bitches out there. If they would only change, I wouldn't have to drink. And we find that our thinking needs to be reversed about 180 degrees on that one. One of the first things you learn is all of your problems are of your own making. You know? And boy, that's one that's tough to take. I remember thinking that was a typo first time I read that. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup. Did I read that? Okay, we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, these are instructions, by the way. These are things you need to do in the second step. You need to sweep away prejudice, you need to think honestly, and you need to search diligently within yourself. Those are second step requirements. Then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. So don't forget those requirements. In this book, you will read the experience of a man who thought he was an atheist. His story is so interesting, some of it should be told now. His change of heart was dramatic, convincing, and moving. Our friend was a minister's son. He attended church school where he became rebellious at what he thought was an overdose of religious education. Does anyone in here relate to that? Usually the people that went to Catholic school for 12 years can relate to that. For years thereafter, he was dogged by trouble and frustration. Business failure, insanity, fatal illness, suicide. These calamities in his immediate family embittered and depressed him. Post-war disillusionment, even more serious alcoholism, impending mental and physical collapse, brought him to the point of self-destruction. One night when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. By someone who had taken the 12 steps and was carrying that message to others. Our friend's gorge rose as he bitterly cried out, "If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me." But later, alone in his room, he asked himself this question: "Is it possible that all the religious people I have known are wrong?" While pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. "Who are you to say there is no God?" This man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of an infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator. This was a sudden and profound spiritual experience. Bill Wilson also had a sudden and profound spiritual experience. But if you go to the spiritual appendix in this book, you'll see that most of us, and I'll say 99% of us, have what is known as the educational variety of spiritual awakening. And what that is that happens slowly over a period of time, working a course of action. That's the way mine came. I've had little bits of spiritual revelations. I think anybody that gets to the point where they need to be detoxed from alcohol gets God shots every once in a while. You know, the clouds part, and let in a little truth every once in a while. But mainly what we have is the slow, painful kind, you know, which takes quite a while. A lot of step work, a lot of working with a sponsor, a lot of meetings, a lot of service. Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. No later vicissitude has shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away. That very night, years ago, it disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. At some times, a great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly, he could not drink if he would. God had restored his sanity. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his Maker, then he knew. Even so, has God restored us all to our right minds. That's a plus. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly. But he has come to all who have honestly sought him. That's another requirement, to honestly seek God. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us.